KQED.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org. And URS, a global engineering and construction firm working to improve California's public infrastructure, preserve the state's natural resources, and strengthen the environment. URS.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Tara Seiler in for Scott Schaefer. On the show today, the death of suspected murderer Christopher Dorner is confirmed, but the controversy over his allegations against the LAPD is very much alive. Plus, a new program helps straight HIV-positive men become fathers through an unconventional approach, unprotected sex with your partner.
He's on his meds, and it's a really, really, really low chance of me getting it, and I just, like, I love him, you know what I mean? Like, it's not a big issue.
And an untold chapter in California's water history, as written by the Paiute Indians.
It means a lot to me. It means this is what my people created. Without anybody's thought or ideas, they did it all on their own.
It's the California Report. Well, the manhunt is over and the body of suspected murderer Christopher Dorner has been positively identified. Dorner's alleged murder spree left four people dead, including two officers. Three others were injured. But the allegations by the former Los Angeles police officer against the LAPD are opening some old wounds, especially in the black community. In an online manifesto, Dorner alleged he was unjustly fired from the LAPD after reporting that a fellow officer kicked a mentally ill suspect. Dorner, who was black, also accused officers of using racial slurs. Meanwhile, the L.A. Police Department is moving forward with a review into Dorner's dismissal back in 2008. We're joined by Connie Rice, a civil rights attorney in Los Angeles. She's represented many black officers over the years who have sued the LAPD. Ms. Rice, given your own experience as a civil rights attorney, do any of Dorner's allegations ring true to you?
Yes, they do. And when I read the manifesto, my heart sank. But I also know that the LAPD of today is not Daryl Gates' LAPD, and it's not the LAPD that my clients had to battle. We're quite a ways away from the days when the leadership of LAPD actually condoned and embraced openly racist, misogynistic, anti-Semitic behavior.
And yet his allegations seem to have struck a raw nerve in the city, especially in the black community. You know, he's been called on some social media postings, have said his actions were wrong, but they clearly sympathized with him. Some have called him a hero. Are you surprised by these responses?
No, not at all. And, you know, for the next 20 years, every time there's a high-profile incident, we should expect to see the kind of residual community memory of LAPD to come to the fore, because there was a war between LAPD and the black community in LA, and the abuse and the emasculation and the mass humiliation that LAPD inflicted on the black community is not going to disappear. Those feelings about that mistreatment are not going to disappear overnight.
Police Chief Charlie Beck says he's going to open an inquiry into Dorner's firing. And Beck made this announcement while speaking with CBS, and we have a little bit of tape explaining his decision. Let's listen to that.
I'm not doing this to appease him. I'm doing this so that the community has faith in what the police department does. And I'm going to make a rigorous inspection to either validate or refute his claims, and we'll make that inspection public.
So what impact do you think this review might have on, you know, people's skepticism about the LAPD?
I think the chief needs to take this moment and create the teaching moment of life. And he can stand up and look at the public and say, whether we can ever figure out definitively what happened to Dorner, here's what I do know. I'm a white officer, and I grew up with my black LAPD brothers, and I know what they went through. And he can lay out that history in a raw, honest way. And then he can say those days are over. We're not having that anymore. And I'm here to pledge to you that the ghosts of LAPD's past are dead.
And yet during the manhunt for Dorner, two innocent women were shot without warning. Their truck was riddled with bullets by police. And there was also this decision to use a highly flammable canister on Dorner, which we think led to the burning of the cabin. This can't build confidence in the city.
Well, no. I mean, but those are separate issues. One is a total panic situation. I think those cops can kiss their careers away. You're supposed to be a professional, and you're not supposed to panic like that, and they did. So that's one issue. Any time you have a takedown of a suspect like this, it's not going to end nicely for anybody. And those canisters of hot tear gas, they always set stuff on fire. You know, I know about the conspiracy theories in the community and so forth, but I found nothing tactically unusual about anything they did. If anything, they were extremely conservative. I expected them to shoot him down in cold blood. I really did. And they would have been in their rights to do so.
So just one last question. Let's look forward. In your mind, what does LAPD need to do to improve its policing? If you could point to one or two things that, you know, kind of next steps.
They need a course taught in the academy that's entitled Why They Hate Us. There are young cops in LAPD today who are very confused by the community seeing T-shirts supporting Dorner and bumper stickers supporting Dorner because they don't know the history of LAPD. They don't know that LAPD used to make a sport of hunting black people. And so that needs to be taught. The second thing is that they need to change their discipline system. I have written a report before that said they needed to get rid of the Board of Rights system and they needed to get rid of their... It's a very incestuous, politicized system that doesn't look for facts, doesn't try to figure out what happened in a certain situation given any complaint that they're trying to adjudicate. Further down the line and away and apart from this incident, the Community Safety Partnership Police, these are cops who are problem-solving cops. They are solving the problems of poor communities, and the community reveres them. That's what we need to expand, and that's the work of the future.
All right, Ms. Rice, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, you're more than welcome.
Connie Rice is a civil rights attorney based in Los Angeles. Advances in medical science are letting people living with HIV rekindle dreams, including having a family. A San Francisco program that's helped HIV-positive women have babies for years has recently launched a program thought to be the first of its kind. It helps straight HIV-positive men become dads. The California Report's health reporter Mina Kim has more.
In a little office at San Francisco General Hospital, Dion Brimmer shifts uneasily in his chair as he talks about his HIV, how he tested positive while he was in jail 4 years ago, how he thought his life was over. But he relaxes and smiles the moment he starts talking about his fiance, Caroline Watson.
What I love most about Caroline is that she's really, really sure in her decisions, and she really, a lot of things that might be difficult for me comes with ease for her, like making decisions and knowing what's right.
Brimmer and Watson have just come from a prenatal appointment. They're expecting their first child, a girl, and neither the baby nor the mom has HIV. The couple actually conceived their child the old-fashioned way, meaning they had unprotected sex. Watson says she's really not too concerned about getting HIV.
He's on his meds, and it's a really, really, really low chance of me getting it, and I just, like, I love him, you know what I mean? Like, it's not a big issue.
Caroline Watson isn't blinded by love. Her understanding that she's unlikely to get HIV from her partner is grounded in medical science, says Dr. Deborah Cohan. She runs the hospital's Bay Area Perinatal AIDS Center, which is treating the couple. Cohan says with the discovery of drugs to treat the virus, people with HIV are living long, healthy lives.
We know that if the person who's positive takes antiretrovirals, and their viral load is suppressed, meaning the medication is working at killing all the HIV in the blood, that the likelihood of them passing HIV to a sexual partner is essentially zero.
Essentially zero, but not absolutely zero, Cohan says, because there's some concern the virus can be in genital fluid even when it's not detected in blood. The Bay Area Center has helped HIV-positive women have healthy babies for more than 2 decades, and last year, the center launched a new program to help HIV-positive men with goals of having families. Called Pro-Men, it teaches men about a range of reproductive options, from adoption to in vitro fertilization, where an egg is fertilized in a lab dish, to, yes, carefully timed intercourse.
We, I would say, as a HIV provider community, have really failed these men. We've really have not created programs to help them realize those goals and do so safely.
Having safe sex, Cohan says, means foregoing condoms only when a female partner is ovulating. Women can also take antiretroviral drugs, which some studies show can protect against HIV. But this kind of message runs counter to the public health message that's been put out for years: always use a condom. Neither state public health officials nor officials with the Federal Centers for Disease Control would comment for this story. The research and advocacy group American Society for Reproductive Medicine has called the practice unsafe and not recommended. So far, the San Francisco program is thought to be the first of its kind. And David Evans, with the AIDS activist group Project Inform, says it may stay that way for a while.
I think stigma is still very, very strong in society about HIV in general.
Evans has been following HIV medical advances for decades and pushes for policy changes. He says in some states, doctors have refused to help those with HIV have kids altogether, until about 2 years ago, health officials in Mississippi required people who tested positive for the virus to sign a form saying they would never have children. Evans says a program that says it's okay to let go of condoms could be revolutionary.
I think this really changes things in a quite dramatic way. And it is one of the last big remaining hurdles that I think many heterosexual men and women have to what they would consider living a normal, ordinary life.
Back at San Francisco General, Dion Brimmer takes hold of his fiancée, Caroline Watson's hand. He says these days he worries more about raising a daughter than he does about his HIV.
It's like, oh my God, like, I definitely wanted to know all kind of self-defense, and just, I envision her to be a black belt in karate.
Watson says she's confident they'll be good parents.
We just have a really good relationship. Like, we really talk about everything, and he says that, like, I can make the decisions, but, like, we make decisions together, really. And things are just better when we're together.
The Pro-Men program plans to launch a monthly support group next month that will also be open to men living outside San Francisco. For the California Report, I'm Mina Kim.
Days after this interview, Dion and Caroline welcomed Valerie Louise Brimmer into the world. California is set to create the nation's most ambitious energy makeover for public buildings. That's because Californians overwhelmingly passed Proposition 39, which closes a corporate tax loophole and funnels much of the money to energy efficiency upgrades. The details, however, have been left to state lawmakers, and not surprisingly, there's disagreement over where the funds will go. Rachel Dornhelm reports.
Walk through the quad at Livermore High School with students from the Green Engineering Academy, and you'll get an earful about how their school could benefit from energy efficiency projects.
What would be nice about it if they had skylight.
Yeah.
So more natural lighting can come in, you know, wouldn't use as much light, and it helps students concentrate more, so.
Yeah. Natasha Moore and Lila Hassan are part of a student team that's saving the school thousands of dollars. The group completed a district-wide energy audit with the help of an engineering firm. Lila leads the way to a small kitchen area.
We're actually inside the teacher's staff room.
The students point out a new motion sensor on the snack machine that keeps the lights and cooler from running idly. And the students aren't stopping with this temporary fix. They want to buy the latest energy-efficient machine.
The cost to actually get it done would be $2,365.
That's Priya Sritharan. That might sound steep, but she says it would almost pay for itself the first year with $2,000 in energy savings.
If you turn down the little stuff, it's going to eventually add up. I think that's why we're talking about getting the little things replaced, like the vending machines and stuff, because those will eventually add up over time.
Susan Kinder agrees. She's the chief business official for Livermore's school district.
We've been saving between 15% to 20% of our electricity bills already, just with the small changes that we have done so far.
That's about $300,000 a year from doing the little stuff. Kinder says she'd like to do more, but in a funding environment where their current energy savings are being plowed back into keeping academic programs afloat, where do you get the initial investment?
That is the huge hurdle, yeah.
Enter the windfall from Proposition 39, a ballot measure bankrolled almost single-handedly by hedge fund billionaire Tom Steyer. The measure closed a corporate tax loophole, which will raise an estimated $1.1 billion a year. Ultimately, it will all go into the state general fund, but Steyer says for the first 5 years, there's a different plan.
So we would take half the money and use it to retrofit public schools in California or public office buildings, and that would both create, you know, tens of thousands of construction jobs. It would also be an investment so that in spending this money, we would then save money for the next 25 years because we'd have reduced energy bills.
Altogether, the measure is expected to generate more than $2.5 billion in new money by 2018 for energy efficiency projects, an unprecedented windfall. Experts project the money could fund efficiency upgrades at half of California's public schools, shaving 20 to 40% off of monthly utility bills. But who should get these grants in the first place? Governor Jerry Brown's proposed budget has it spread around all public schools. Others disagree, including State Senator Kevin De Leon, a Los Angeles Democrat.
Every school district is different. You got some school districts who have brand new schools, and within the same school district, you have schools that are just extremely old, that emit a lot of carbon and waste energy.
And then there's a phrase on many people's lips.
You know, we always look for low-hanging fruit.
Not just low-hanging fruit.
Some of the low-hanging fruit.
In other words, basic energy efficiency upgrades, like new windows and lighting. Senator De Leon says these provide the most savings for the least cost. Adam Browning, with the nonprofit group Vote Solar, argues there's also a chance here for an expansion of renewable energy, like solar. Browning says the ballot measure explicitly included clean energy solutions in its language.
They didn't just show pictures of compact fluorescents. There were plenty of solar panels that were used to sell this, and so that should be honored.
At Livermore High, Priya Sritharan and the other students all agreed, however the details work out, it's the ultimate investment.
So it's important to invest money in schools because we're like the future of the country.
State lawmakers are expected to pass a plan to distribute the money later this summer. For the California Report, I'm Rachel Dornhelm.
Over the last few years, the name Tao Nguyen has found its way into the consciousness of indie music fans. She's a favorite of hipster music blogs and even has a video directed by a star from Glee. Now she's got a new album, We the Common, with her band, the Get Down Stay Down, that goes beyond the hype, showcasing not only her pop, but her politics. The California Report's pop music critic Steve Hockman has our review.
If I bend my youth, would it come to me? Oh, love, won't you bat my eye? I miss the sweet garden man, baffle a skeleton dry.
There's a video on YouTube I want you to see. It's a clip of a recent performance by Tao Nguyen singing the title song of her new album, We the Common. But unlike the album version, which features her band the Get Down Stay Down, this is her solo, playing banjo and singing through a battery-powered megaphone at a protest rally outside the Central California Women's Facility in Chowchilla. The song is dedicated to Valerie Bolton, a life-term inmate Nguyen befriended while doing outreach programs there. And clearly, Nguyen is fired up and wants you to be too. When she gets to the whooping, wordless chorus, you may well want to whoop right along, just as if she were Pete Seeger or Joan Baez. But neither this nor anything else on this album is what you'd call a protest song. And even removed from that video's context, this is compelling and a fine kickoff to a highly engaging, highly distinctive album by a talent who, after building a buzz on the West Coast indie scene for a few years now, is really hitting her stride. No wonder she's whooping. The music is folky in a loose sense, but not folk. It's more about exuberance and spirit, not any particular style. And the politics she professes, by and large, are personal. Take the song Everybody, in which she sings, "Save my bed for the big ideas."
Everybody has a body above. Yes, we get naked, but not naked enough.
Kind of hard to imagine Pete Seeger leading a sing-along of that. The real appeal of Tao Nguyen is she is, well, Tao Nguyen, an individual, even an eccentric in the best sense of the word. And here she gets help from kindred and hard-to-define spirit Joanna Newsom, the harp-playing sprite, who joins Nguyen on the countryish Kindness Be Conceived, the two distinctive voices bringing out the playfulness and the almost Shakespearean lilt of the lyrics.
Kindness be conceived. When we wake in the California light, there is a concrete stuck between how we breathe and why we die. Why we breathe and why we die.
And then there's the Get Down, Stay Down. Not so much a band as a concept, a variable community of musicians, versatile and creative enough to bring to life every one of Whim's, well, not whims, but, okay, whims. With shifting combinations of guitars, horns, vibes, strings, keyboards, and whatnot, she and this crew can go from the Black Keys-like guitar stomp of City to the horn-slathered folk funk of We Don't Call.
We don't call, we don't write. We love some strangers every night, oh no.
The thread through it all might best be captured in the song Human Heart.
I can see your ribs when you sing. Even won't you be?
Well, that's what powers We the Common. It's passion. It's engagement. It's sensuality. It's the truly uncommon Tao.
Long live the end of a life of relief.
Steve Hockman is a Los Angeles-based writer who covers pop music for the California Report and KPCC. He reviewed We the Common by Tao and the Get Down, Stay Down. The water wars that drained the Owens Valley 100 years ago to feed the Los Angeles Aqueduct are today the stuff of literary and cinematic legend. But one group's story has been left out. Before the arrival of white settlers, Paiute Indians had a sophisticated water system of their own. This year marks the centennial anniversary of the aqueduct's construction, and a documentarian is working with the native community to uncover this lost part of California's water history. Alex Schmidt reports.
Working on a documentary project in the Owens Valley on land owned by the L.A. Department of Water and Power can be a little dicey.
Is DWP land? Because they're right there.
I don't care.
Looking at us. I'm just telling you.
UC Berkeley scholar Jenna Cavell is out with Harry Williams, Paiute elder, for one of their mapping expeditions. Though DWP is aware of the project, the two haven't asked permission to make trips onto department property.
We're okay because we're with him, and there's sort of a sanctuary agreement between DWP and the natives, like they're allowed to come out on the land.
This is our homeland. Kick me off. You're going to have to drag me.
Using archival maps and GPS, the two are starting at the bottom of the valley floor and ascending into the foothills. They're plotting different points of the ancient Paiute irrigation and drainage system that crisscrosses this landscape a couple hundred miles north of Los Angeles.
A river or a stream could not make it through here. There's not enough of an incline. And so the Paiute would create these ditches to bring water out into these valley floors to exploit the plants and the life and bring life into this area, because it's much easier for them to hunt and gather in a landscape like this than up in the mountains.
To our west is the hulking backside of the snow-capped Sierras, Yosemite beyond them. East are the huge, chunky brown Inyo Mountains. The tan and gray valley floor in between holds countless of these unassuming-looking drainage canals, some of which feed into the aqueduct, though most are empty. Cavell says they're significant, especially now.
The fact that we can talk about this 100 years of diverting the water to supply LA and to not talk about the fact that the water was being engineered by the native population prior to that, it's historically inaccurate.
So here is a little history. Paiutes are known to have inhabited the Owens Valley for at least 800 years, possibly thousands. No one really knows when the irrigation system was built. White settlers started arriving in the mid-1800s, and soon after, the Indian Wars began. Paiutes were pushed up into the hills for years. When they returned, their water systems had been taken over, and their previous way of life was gone. Then in 1905, the LADWP started buying up land from farmers, diverting the water to feed the aqueduct.
Can you show me which one on the map, though, that we're going to?
Show me the other map.
We're deeper into the landscape now, near some water that flows from lakes up in the Sierras. Using the data they collect, Cavell will create maps of reservation irrigation systems, museum exhibits, and a documentary film. Harry Williams has been curious about the ditches for a long time, since he stumbled upon a relic of an irrigation dam when he was 12 years old.
I was about a mile that way, and I was playing around. There was a headgate. I'm in a desert. Why is this irrigation headgate out in the middle of a desert?
Did you ever ask your parents?
Our history was never taught. It never was. I had an old guy, because I asked a couple old people, did you guys ever hear about them? He goes, I always wondered what that was.
Paiute historical knowledge has been lost over the generations. Many elders today have never heard about the wars that ravaged their tribe 150 years ago. For Williams, documenting the ditch system means resurrecting his history. We drive up higher. Here is a truly impressive ditch, around 5 feet deep. The Paiutes dug this with a huge stick called a pavado.
It means a lot to me. It means this is what my people created. Without anybody's thought or ideas, they did it all on their own. Think of the genius it took for somebody to convince the rest of the people to do this system and what they would get out of it. And I've always went off that, well, I'll be the genius guy who brings it back alive.
The LADWP doesn't have plans to include Paiute water history in its centennial ceremonies. Still, Harry Williams and Jenna Cavell hope that this year, the Paiute story will become a real part of California water history. For the California Report, I'm Alex Schmidt in the Owens Valley.
That's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. You can always find us online at californiareport.org, and of course, we're on Facebook, too. Our director is Susie Racho. The technical producer is Seal Muller. We had additional engineering from Howard Gelman and Rob Spate. The online team includes Lisa Pickoff-White, David Marks, and Don Clyde. Our interns are Guy Marzorati and Gina Shalaba. Craig Miller was a contributing editor. The associate senior producer is Victoria Malion. The senior producer is Ingrid Becker. The executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Tara Seiler. Scott Schaefer returns next week. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, celebrating the 2013 recipients of the James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards. More information is available at www.irvine.org. The California Endowment, Health Happens in Schools, at calendow.org. And Chevron, committed to helping California grow by supporting small businesses and investing in education. More information available at chevron.com.